Consumer Affairs will come to order. Good morning, everyone. I have a couple announcements about this agenda today. House Bill 3322 will be moved to Friday. Apologize for anybody who is here on that bill. Senate Bill 355A will not be heard today as well. And we're going to change the order. Senate Bill 285 and 515 will be up first.
206.
Oh, it's 206. Excuse me. Senate Bill 206 and 515 will be up first due to time constraints for the people presenting that bill. So I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 206. And Jana Jarvis, come forward. With Scott Taylor, is that correct? And we'll have the committee read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 206A requires real estate brokers to secure separate client trust accounts, restricts brokers' use of funds, provides real estate commission oversight of accounts, authorizes commission to create records related to the trust fund accounts, and reconciles discrepancies in current statutes related to a specific three-year period.
Good morning.
Morning, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Taylor. I'm the Oregon Real Estate Commissioner. To my right is Jana Jarvis with the Oregon Association of Realtors. To my left is Christine Shute with the Attorney General's Office. Speak to you for House Bill, Senate Bill 206A. This bill makes technical changes primarily to reconcile discrepancies between effective and operative and repeal dates that are in Chapter 300 of Oregon Laws 2001. That was Senate Bill 446 of last session. Sections 1 and 5 and 7 of Chapter 300 provide for qualification of licensees as of the effective date of the Act and provide that certain education courses be completed within 3 years of the effective date of the Act. However, Section 5 provides for the repeal of certain sections on January 1, and the bill didn't become operative until July 1 of 2002. And the bill, what part of this bill does is reconcile those dates. There's additional changes that are of a housekeeping nature, making technical and typographical changes for clarity and to better describe intent. Section 10A of this bill, and I believe you have Senate Bill 206-A3, make some changes to ORS 696-301 as a result of two court cases. First is Dearborn versus Real Estate Agency, which interprets the authority of the agency to protect the public extremely narrowly. The second is Curley versus the Real Estate Agency, where the Oregon Court of Appeals, relying on the Supreme Court's opinion in Dearborn, confirmed that Dearborn substantially narrows the authority the agency had to protect the public.
Scott, does everybody have, excuse me, the A3 in front of them? Because I'm having trouble locating mine.
Yep.
Please continue. Thank you.
At about the time this bill received its third reading, and if you can follow me here, you're probably ahead of me, and passed the Senate, Senate Bill 893 was heard, which addressed the same concerns. Originally, the amendments to Senate Bill 893 would have included the amendments to ORS 696-301 sub 31, but it were different than the amendments to this bill. Last week, Senate Bill 893 passed out of committee with a due pass recommendation. The agency believes the changes to ORS 696-301-31 that were originally proposed to be in the amendment to Senate Bill 893 better address the problem than the amendments originally proposed here, and therefore we have submitted these dash amendments to the committee's consideration to amend 696-301-31 as presented here in Section 10A of the bill, and those are found at page 10, lines 23 through 25 accordingly. I have Ms. Shute here who can much better explain the impact of Dearborn and Curley than I can, and I think at this point I defer to her.
Could I ask you, in the amendment, you've added the term professional. I'm wondering how that changes what's in the desk, in the ANGRA.
Madam Chair, the biggest change in that particular amendment, as I understand it, and Ms. Shute probably can expand on that if necessary, deals with the portion of the section that says, and whether or not in the course of professional real estate activity. If you understand the impacts of Dearborn and Curley and what they did, it'll make more sense to
you. Okay, thank you.
Good morning. My name is Christine Shute. I'm from the Oregon Department of Justice, General Counsel Division. I'm here to talk about Senate Bill 206. The cases that Scott has mentioned, Dearborn and Curley, were cases that parsed the Oregon statute very, very, very carefully and very, very narrowly. It's perhaps a little bit important for you to understand those cases. In Dearborn involved a real estate broker who had admitted trading drugs for sex, including with at least one minor. And as a result of a plea bargain with the local prosecutor, had pleaded down to essentially two drug possession charges from seven total charges, including prostitution and contributing to the delinquency of a minor type charge. The real estate commissioner had serious concerns about this person holding a real estate license because, as you know, realtors and brokers have access to lockboxes on people's homes, whether the people are home or not, and thereby could have access to the medicine cabinet in a private home or even access to unsupervised children in a private home. And the commissioner tried to discipline Mr. Dearborn. The courts told us that the statute didn't permit him to do that because the trades of drugs for sex and whatnot had not taken place with clients or with the children of clients, and therefore the statute did not give the commissioner authority to discipline him. This bill would change that. If you look at the Dash 3 amendments, the language, whether or not in the course of professional real estate activity, would open the door for the commissioner to take disciplinary action or to limit the license of someone based on conduct that was not specifically tied to their professional activity, but which had a substantial relationship to being qualified or fit to conduct that real estate activity. The Curley case is a similar kind of case. A gentleman was disbarred from the practice of law for being involved in dishonest activity involving specifically real estate sales and purchase activity. However, he was not acting as a realtor. He was acting as a private person or as a lawyer, I don't know which. But in that case, the court said, no, you don't have the authority to discipline him because he wasn't acting as a realtor when he did that dishonest real estate activity. So you can see that those are extremely narrow readings of the commissioner's authority to discipline, and a very limited, it substantially limits the commissioner's ability to protect the public from dishonesty. So that's why we're here today on the Dash 3 amendments and Section 10 of this bill. I'd be glad to answer any questions that anyone may have about that.
Questions from the committee? Representative Rosenbaum. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Christine, this other bill that your testimony refers to, that sounds like it's headed over here now, too. Does that essentially do the same thing, but more broadly?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, yes, it does. I have been calling this our belt and suspenders approach. Since the Supreme Court has interpreted the language that is specific to the real estate agency, we felt the need to address that language directly. In addition, the other bill would amend a chapter of the Oregon Revised Statutes that applies to all licensing boards, and it would make it clear that all licensing boards have the ability to consider conduct that does not occur directly in the course of professional practice.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you address the degree to which this bill is retroactive? And is it, if it is retroactive, is that specifically to address the case you've been discussing?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, I'm not sure whether this bill is retroactive. I know that the other bill, the other bill that's coming over to you, Senate Bill 893, is specifically not retroactive. And I defer to Scott about whether there's an effectiveness clause on this one. I don't have a copy of the bill with me.
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, I'm trying to read very fast here, but as I recall, this bill has an emergency clause that would be effective on passage.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, I don't believe that there was ever any intent in this bill to go back and pick up those two gentlemen whose cases have already been fully litigated in the courts.
If I can follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
I'm looking specifically at Section 14 of the bill, which notes that this will apply to licensing activity as of January 1st, 2002. That's what drew my attention to it.
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know that I can give you a truly legally accurate answer to this, but I think what I would say is it may go back, because if you look at Senate Bill 446, what happened was the bill became effective January 1st, 2002. It became operative July 1st, 2002, and there was a three-year period there where licensees who were transferring from salesperson to broker had to get some education. A strict reading of the bill would have said they would have only had 2.5 years after the bill became operative, and so what it does is it attempts to reconcile those dates so they get their 3 years.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks.
Excuse me, are you referring to Section 14?
Yes.
At the very end. Okay. Mm-hmm. Other questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. And we'll call Christine Shute. Oh, I'm sorry, Christine did come up. Across us here, Robin White.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Robin White, Executive Vice President and CEO of BOMA, Building Owners and Managers Association, and then actually the same position for five other commercial real estate associations. Many of my members are licensees of the real estate agency, as they are brokers, leasing agents, property managers, and basically we're just here today to just support Scott's position that Senate Bill 206, as it stands, is a very important bill for those licensees that have gotten caught in the time problem that happened between the operative dates of the former legislation and the date that it went into effect. Scott has done a great job in explaining what we're doing, so I just wanted to go on record saying we feel that this bill is very important and urge your support. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much. Okay, that concludes our testimony on Senate Bill 206A. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 206A. Representative Kipps.
Madam Chair, I would move the dash three amendments into 206A.
Representative Kipps moves the dash three amendment into Senate Bill 206A. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kipps.
I would move Senate Bill 206A as amended to the floor with the due-pass recommendation.
Representative Kipps moves Senate Bill 206A as amended to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Votes aye. Motion carries. And Senate Bill 206 moves to the floor, and we need a carrier.
You have to volunteer, I'm sure.
Representative Merkley volunteers to carry this bill. Thank you very much. Close the work session. Okay. came open a public hearing on Senate Bill 515A and have the staff read the summary. Call Janet Jarvis and Rich Vile.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 515 modifies requirements for seller's disclosure or disclaimer related to sale of residential real property. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. For the record, I'm Janet Jarvis with the Oregon Association of Realtors. I didn't mean to preempt you, but I did bring up a couple of members that are going to speak to the provisions in Senate Bill 515 prior to Rich Vile coming up and speaking, if I may. Senate Bill 515 is brought to you by the Oregon Association of Realtors and is the product of a work group that our association has had put in place about a year and a half ago to address problems that came out of the seller's disclosure form, which was a result of some 1993 legislation. And both Matt Farmer, who's our Associate General Counsel for the Oregon Association of Realtors, and Steve Lucas, who's a partner in Oregon Realty, one of the large firms up in the Portland metro area, were members of that particular work group and are going to speak to you about the specifics of that. But prior to that, I wanted to let you know that you do see this as an amended version. There were some issues that we did address on the Senate side that were brought by other individuals that had concerns with the seller's disclosure form. Specifically, one of those was a provision that Senator Vicky Walker had introduced. She had some language concerning mold, which is the new fun subject if you're in real estate now. And so we substituted her language into our bills for the provisions that we had in there originally, and we're appreciative to her for that, having brought that forward. In addition to that, the DEQ has a couple of concerns about septic systems, and the condominium group had some concerns about homeowners associations, which are addressed in the amendments that came out of on the Senate side. And so we'll speak to those things specifically as we move forward with our testimony. But I want to thank you for the opportunity to present this morning, and then I'll let Matt discuss some of the specifics.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, Matt Farmer, Associate General Counsel for the Oregon Association of Realtors. This bill is necessary to correct some problems that we've had with sellers' property disclaimer and disclosure. That idea, simple idea that sellers in residential transactions ought to tell buyers something of what they know of the condition of the property, is something that realtors championed about 10 years ago. And so we have a decade of experience working with the present legislation. This is designed to address some issues that have arisen to make this statute more useful to consumers and more helpful in real estate transactions. So the general outline of what we've changed is, first of all, the disclosure disclaimer problem was that people had to choose one or the other, and lawyers tended to advise clients to always disclaim, which of course defeated the purpose of the bill, which was to have sellers tell the buyer something of what they knew of the property. So this bill eliminates the disclaimer as a statutory option. Sellers can still disclaim. It's just not part of the statute. The statute asks them to disclose what they know. If they are unwilling to do that or they want to disclaim, that's fine, but the buyer then has the right to revoke their offer all the way until the closing. If they will disclose, then they have 5 business days in which to revoke the offer, and that revocation must be based on the content of the disclosure. The reason for that is we found that a number of buyers were using the present law, which requires it has an automatic right of revocation without reference to the disclosure. We're using it as a way to gain an option on property over a short period of time. In other words, they would tie somebody's property up and then maybe do 2 or 3 offers and then choose the one they wanted. We felt that was a misuse of the law. Other things that that we wanted to straighten out in addition to the substance of the disclosure itself, which I think Steve will speak to, is there was some confusion in the legal community about whether this disclosure was actually the seller's or whether it was the real estate licensees. There were attempts by lawyers to hold real estate licensees liable for the statements of the seller. We don't believe that's right, and this bill corrects that. What it says is that real estate agents are not liable for the misstatements of the seller. However, they are and continue to be liable for their own misstatements. The way that would play out is if a seller were to misrepresent on the form, that's their misrepresentation and they're responsible for it. If the real estate agent knew that, or in the exercise of reasonable care should have known that and remains quiet, that's their misrepresentation. So we think that draws the right boundary of responsibility there. Former way that the disclosure was set up was all the questions were prefaced by do you know or are you aware, and that didn't seem to us to be very workable because we're dealing with ordinary citizen sellers who are involved in a residential transaction. This doesn't apply to commercial real estate at all. They would say, I don't know, or that doesn't really apply. And so the new form gives them that option to just say, well, I don't know. That some concern that could be abused, we don't believe that that's possible for the very simple reason that if I do know something and I answer a question unknown, that is untruthful and would itself be a misrepresentation. So we don't. We feel this will help help people use the form. It's important also in the regard that one of the exceptions to this law has been people that never occupied the property. And what, for instance, somebody that owns a house that's a rental. What we know from experience is those people often know more about the condition of the property than just the average homeowner, and yet they don't have to make these disclosures. That particular exception is eliminated, and because they can say things that they don't know about because they haven't lived there, that works, but they can tell about the title and defects that they do know about. There was also, finally, there have been some difficulties in the industry about when the 5-day revocation period starts to run. The new bill makes it clear that if you deal through real estate agents to make an offer, then the 5-day period will start to run when the agent receives the disclosure. And we believe that that's reasonable because the parties have already started to deal with each other. So that's the substance of the bill. I'd be happy to answer any of that's the structure of the bill. I think Steve's going to talk to some of the substantive changes, and of course we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Gerard, did you have a question?
Yes, I did. Thank you. In the Senate amendments, on line 17, I guess what I want to know is, it says, has any portion of the property been tested or treated? That's kind of like saying, have you ever gone to the hospital for something? I mean, there may be nothing wrong, but that's kind of intimating, regardless of how you answer it, that, I mean, you may have had something tested to prove there was nothing wrong. And that kind of indicates that maybe there is something wrong with the property. And it's just the wording in the question.
Chairman Close, Representative Gerard, that particular provision is just one of several that deal with mold and other potential defects. There are places in the disclosure that ask about water intrusion, the existence of particular things. That amendment came from Senator Walker and was part of another bill of hers that was aimed directly at a problem in Eugene regarding tests for mold that had not been disclosed. And so at her request on the other side, we adopted that language. So yes, it would work that way, but we believe that other provisions in the disclosure would point at the kinds of problems that you're concerned about.
Madam Chairman, please.
Mr. Shoffman.
I wasn't going to bring it up, but since the word came out your mouth. You know, I grew up in the Midwest, and I lived here since 1988, and every single building I've lived in or worked on has mold in it. Now, unfortunately, there's some folks out there that have a problem with mold, and I feel sorry for them, and I'm sympathetic to them. Is this mold issue growing, or is it shrinking?
Well, I'll see if I can, Chairman Close, Representative, I'll see if I can stay with the biological reference here. The problem is growing in some regards in the sense that there's a lot of uncertainty in the industry over litigation regarding mold. We don't have anything that would suggest to us that there's any more or less mold growing in Oregon than there ever has been. And how that problem is being worked through, what we have done and what this forum will, I think, help do is make people aware of that it's a potential problem for some individuals. And those individuals then would want to rely on the testing that's available for that. But we don't see it as a general problem with property in Oregon. As opposed to anywhere else. It's something that people should be aware of. This, many of the changes that we made to this form are to try and address that problem in a way that doesn't make things worse by focusing on the source of that problem, which is water intrusion, rather than mold itself. And that's why I think Senator Walker's suggestions were helpful. Because if you ask the general question, are you aware of any mold? The answer is yes, but if there's no information. And so here we try to ask specific questions. Are you aware of water intrusion problems? Have they been repaired? Have you filed any claims? Have you had remediation done? Have you had testing done? Those kinds of more concrete things that point at a specific problem rather than sort of this general fear. So I appreciate the question. It's...
I'm glad I got a laugh.
It's a growing problem.
Representative Kitts.
This is for clarification, if I might, from the representative and gentleman from Klamath Falls, if he will answer a question.
Representative Garrard, would you answer a question?
I'm sorry, yes, of course.
Thank you, Chair. With regards to your question, has any portion of the property been tested? I think I understand your question to lead... basically that it's implicating yes, it's been tested, but there's no slot to say and nothing was found.
Correct.
I'm sorry.
I appreciate that clarification, Madam Chairman, Representative Kitts. The way that is handled in those issues are handled in this form is that there's a general instruction to the seller. If you answer particular questions and you have documents, then they're to be attached. And you'll find that at the end of the disclosure statement.
So it says, if I might, I'm sorry to interrupt. It says that if, I just want to make sure that I see it. So it says somewhere that if you answer yes to any of the following questions, please attach appropriate documents.
Yes, that's correct.
It says it right there on line 21, almost verbatim. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Berg.
Just a comment. If I had mold in my house and I wanted to sell it, I'd get a can of paint, and I'd probably paint over the mold and keep my mouth shut. And that way I could answer no to that question.
Madam Chairman, Senator Berg, I think, and Steve might want to comment on this, I think if you used a real estate professional in that transaction, they would strongly urge you to not take that approach and would probably refuse to represent you in that case. And here's why. Failure to disclose repairs, that would be a repair. And what basically what you're saying is, well, yeah, I had a problem, but I repaired it, so it's no longer a problem, and therefore I get to say no. What happens in that case is when the problem comes back, the mold grows back through the paint, which it will, then the buyer will get a lawyer and say, you know, I got this mold problem they didn't tell me about. Your attempt to repair it will now be characterized in court as an attempt to deceive the buyer by covering it up. Very dangerous situation.
Madam Chair.
Does that represent Gerard's question?
That's why we think the disclosure is so important, is to help people understand those potential pitfalls. So what you would do is answer yes and attach the repair, and then the buyer makes up their own mind on whether that's sufficient or whatever. That's the safe course of action.
Representative Kitts and then Schaffer.
Representative from Klamath Falls and good friend, I don't think the mold that you're referencing that we all get, like above the shower, say, as just a result of the steam, is the big problem. I think it's a lot of the mold problem that they're speaking of is mold from potential leaks that may leak into your insulation that may not be visible, that may present more of a health problem. There are certain groups that refer to mold as gold, and so that's it's the mold that you can't see. It's not so much the mold that's visible, because a painted over mold is probably detected. It's the one that's inside that is undetectable. I think is probably the problem they're referencing.
Right. I would also point out there's a difference between mold and mildew. They are not the same.
My response to that is that it says here mold. It doesn't distinguish what kind of mold.
Exactly.
Okay, Representative Schaffer.
And that was what I would advise everybody selling a house to check, yes, there's mold in my house. I mean, every house, but painting, I think, is a maintenance thing, not a repair. Is painting defined as a repair? That's my question.
Madam Chairman, Representative, I took the hypothetical to mean that the painting was done to cover up a specific mold problem. But no, if you're just painting, or I think what Representative Kitts was suggesting, you know, if I'm just spraying my shower to hold down the mold that we all know is possible there, that doesn't rise to the level of what we're talking about here. But if I have a discoloration on a wall and I, you know, paint over it just prior to selling the house, then I might have a problem.
17. And there is mildew-resistant paint, correct? Which is a treatment of sort.
It can be. And see, then you have to ask, the seller has to ask themselves, why am I doing the paint? Is it to cover up this, quote, mold? That's something the buyer wants.
Follow up.
Briefly. Look, this is a great idea. I'm not against it. But every single homeowner is going to paint before they sell a house. So the cynical home buyer can go in and say, oh, they've painted. Maybe they're hiding something from me. I think we're, this whole mold issue, as I said, is growing. And I'm sorry, I'm not making another joke here. It's growing into something that it's not, in my opinion.
We certainly agree, and it's something that we've worked on at state and national levels to get information out to the agents to provide to people. There's a report from the American Medical Association that says the existence of mold in residential houses is not a health problem, except for specific hyper allergic people and so on. And so you're right, it is a difficult problem. It's kind of like some people compare it to the asbestos scare of some time ago.
I have a question. I helped my mother, who's in her 90s, just sell her house, which is about an 80-year-old house. And so, you know, you do have a number of things on this list that I appreciate you putting on the list, because, as you say, this allows the buyer then to make the decision whether they want to buy the house or not, and everything's sort of on the table. The question, it used to be years ago that you could write on a contract as is, and that would indicate to the buyer that they're accepting the house as is. Is that still legally correct?
Madam Chairman, it is. It's a widely misunderstood area of the law. In Oregon, as in most states, as-is clauses are taken legally as a representation of no warranty. In other words, I'm saying I'm not warranting the condition of the house, and I'm not making any representations as to the condition of the house. If you know that something's wrong with the house, you can't hide behind an as-is clause. As-is doesn't mean you're taking it with material defects that I know about and I'm not disclosing. That has been the state of the law in Oregon for quite some time. Some confusion about that. As-is does not mean I get to lie to you. It means I'm not aware of any, I'm not warranting the property. I'm not making any representations.
Senator Gordon.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to overdo this, but I've just been sitting here trying to figure out how you tell the difference between mold and mildew.
You taste it.
Thank you, Representative Skibbs.
Thank you. Gets experience in that area.
Madam Chair, Representative Gerard, I don't think that this disclosure requires that kind of distinction to be made. And one of the reasons that we've worked on it is to deal with this problem so that we don't ask those kinds of questions. What we ask instead, just for example, are there any moisture problems, areas of water presentation, mildew odors, or other moisture conditions, especially in the basement? See, so we try to get more at the root of the problem rather than saying, do you have any mildew? That's not a question.
Quick follow-up, Madam.
Follow-up.
So if I have mold, I can answer no to the question, no, I don't have mildew.
Mildew odors.
Yeah. Thank you very much. No more questions.
All righty.
This is a difficult problem. You're both very correct. It's a difficult
Let's
problem.
Go on to is this Matt?
I'm going to ask a question.
Okay, last question because we do have people waiting in the audience who have time constraints.
My question is, what if you checked all unknown on all these? What the seller who can maybe stretch, you know, whatever their interpretation of these questions are, answering unknown to most, how are they then liable if they...
The law would look at that. If I know something and I tell somebody I don't know, that's deceit. It's not just an innocent misrepresentation. It's the intent to deceive. Very difficult for somebody to, for instance, they would be then liable for punitive damages and so on. So saying you don't know when you do is very dangerous activity for a home seller.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Steve, are you?
Yes.
Madam
Chair, committee members, I'm Steve Lucas. I'm a principal broker with Oregon Realty, and I was the chairman of the task force for the seller disclosure. One thing I'd like to point out is that this is not an end-all form. And the other thing is that this puts a prospective purchaser on notice. They have 5 days to rescind the transaction after they receive this. So they get to look at it. And if an area disturbs them, they can rescind the offer. And there's no downside for them, or it can stimulate a need or a desire on their part to do further research or investigation in certain areas. So that's generally what the form is designed to do, is to put them on notice up front that they may want to do more investigation or they may not be satisfied with the property. So it's not in itself an end-all form. The situation with mold, as has been, you know, tossed around in the committee, we're dealing with that on a daily basis. They're on the 11 o'clock news on Channel 6 last night. They were talking about it. So that's an issue that we're going to have to deal with throughout time, and this form is not going to answer that 100% one way or another. The other thing I'd like to point out is the committee members that were on this task force are practitioners, principal brokers from around the state, and there were several attorneys that deal with this that were also on that committee. So it was made up of a group of people that have been dealing with this form since its inception, and they deal with it on a daily basis. So what you're seeing here is a result of what we have all seen as problems in dealing with the forum from the standpoint of the consumer and the standpoint of real estate practitioners. So we tried to use the forum to eliminate a series of forms that we have to use today. A person would have to know, be it a consumer or real estate practitioner, what category a person falls in, so you may have to have several, two or three forms with you. This is all one form, and it's all in its entirety. So you don't have to have three different forms to carry around with you just in case a person falls into an exemption or maybe they want to do a disclaimer. The other thing is that it incorporates other statutes that have come along the way so that we don't have to use other ancillary forms when we're marketing property. As we talked about the new issue surrounding mold, the categories, what we really ran into is the old form said yes or no. With the unknowns and the non-applicables, it gives the consumer a broader range of answering the question because, in my experience, not every seller has crawled around in the crawl space under their house, so they really didn't know what was there. And so this gives them an opportunity to really say, I don't know what's down there, where before they had to say yes or no to these different questions.
But you can get sued.
The impact on the consumer, I think, is going to be much less than it has been in the past. This is a lot easier form. It encompasses a lot of changes in the statutes that have come along since it was initially brought into play, and it'll also help the real estate practitioners deal with the consumer better. Obviously, the real estate practitioners are not filling this form out, but the potential seller is asking them questions, and in many cases, they have to be careful about the questions and how they answer them. Most cases, this was brought up because they didn't have an unknown or a non-applicable answer to use. It was either yes or no. So they would ask a question, well, what do I put? And the agent had really no answer for them. In this case, they will be able to address the issue as an unknown or a non-applicable if that's the case. So all in all, we think that it's a very good form and it will be much easier to use and understand by the consumer and real estate practitioners as a whole.
Madam Chair? Next question, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems like most people have somebody come and inspect the property on their behalf to make sure that they know what they're getting into. And so how does this form relate to a visual inspection like that?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, the seller is not going to do the kind of research that a home inspector might, if that's what you were alluding to. And a home inspector will come in and spend hours in the home, checking, supposedly every part of that property. And so that's going to be a far more thorough inspection than a seller is probably going to do. And the situation where Representative Close was talking about her elderly mother, obviously she probably hasn't done a lot of investigation in the property, but the home inspector is going to go through there and we hope with a fine-tooth comb. And so they would be able to draw out things. And again, the standard unassigned agreement that's used mostly statewide allows the purchaser to resend the transaction if they're not happy with that home inspection also.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Oh, that was too much. Call Matt Farmer and Scott Taylor.
Yep.
Excuse me? Rich Vile. I'm sorry. Okay, that was Matt. Okay. Now we got Rich. Excuse me. And gentlemen, we are about out of time on this bill, so I will ask you to make it brief.
First or last? Go ahead. Madam Chairman, again for the record, I'm Scott Taylor. I'm the Oregon Real Estate Commissioner, and I'll be very brief. I happen to be involved in the preparation and presentation of the 1993 legislation as a realtor, and I can tell you that what you have before you today is a vast improvement on what we have worked with in the industry for years. Additionally, in the last year, as president-elect of the Association of Real Estate License Law Officials, I've worked on a work group with that group, including counterparts from Texas, Louisiana, Maryland, and Colorado, and also an organization called the Employee Relocation Council with this issue of mold. I can tell you that we had two concerns. One is that any disclosure should not be to the point that it creates a stigma, and I think Representative Girard, you alluded to that. The second is any disclosure ought to work towards developing an awareness of the symptoms that would cause mold, and I believe what the amendments to this particular legislation do actually do what we felt the best way to approach this particular issue is. I've learned far more about mold than I ever wanted to know in the last 6 months. I can tell you that a very small percentage of the population is adversely affected by mold. There are tens of thousands of different varieties of mold, and generally the problem where people are affected occurs in four strains of these tens of thousands. So it's become somewhat overblown, but it is an issue that needs to be addressed. Finally, in my own personal experience, both as a broker, as commissioner, and as a consumer, the idea of the disclaimer versus disclosure that you see in current law that's being eliminated here, I believe is a good thing. If you go to one part of the state right now, you'll find most people disclaiming. If you go to another part, you'll find most people disclosing, and it's causing confusion, frankly, both in the minds of real estate practitioners who we regulate, as well as those of the public who may move from one area to the next. There are some changes that have been recommended that have to do with situations where people live, where there may be a homeowners association. I believe that the changes that have been put into here are sufficient to open the eyes of the consumer to ask more questions, and I can speak from my own personal experience. Currently, I live in a townhome complex that has a homeowners association, which is situated inside a planned development that has another homeowners association. That's a very small percentage of the residential real estate that you'll find throughout our state. And the questions that we have today ask the questions that would raise somebody's awareness. But if you go much beyond that, I think what you're going to do is see people either to say, I don't know, or refuse to answer them because they're going to be too detailed and the form's going to be too long. I'm probably as sophisticated as anybody working in that kind of an environment, and I can tell you that those questions go to about the extent of my knowledge. That would conclude my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I'm sorry, we're not going to go to questions. Rich?
Rich Vile. I'm the president of the Northwest HOA Law Center, and I have been working with a group called the Condominium Working Group for about the last 20 years on legislation that deals with condominiums and homeowners associations. We did propose to OAR substantially more changes in terms of additional disclosure that we hope might occur through Chapter 105, but in visiting with OAR have become convinced that what Mr. Taylor just told you is correct. It probably is better to leave the disclosure related to homeowners associations to a separate type of transaction, perhaps something that the homeowners association creates, like a transaction sheet, but not try to load this bill up with issues that would relate only to homeowners associations. I will tell the committee, however, that we currently estimate there are approximately 3,000 homeowners associations in Oregon, representing over 500,000 residents. Virtually no subdivision in Oregon is being created currently that does not have a homeowners association as a component of it. So this is a growing area. We believe that it will require additional legislation, and Oregon Association of Realtors has agreed to work with us in future sessions to try and look at appropriate ways to make sure that disclosure happens. As the bill has been amended on the Senate side, we are in support of it and would urge the committee's passage of the bill.
Quick question.
No, I don't.
Thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 515A. going to open a work session on Senate Bill 515A. Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 515A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 515A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Garrard.
Madam Chair, I just have a little problem with the Senate amendments again in this thing. I think it really opens the door to a lot of litigation between both buyer and seller that I'm not quite sure the bill start. I mean, the bill is a great idea, and it's a good bill in that respect, but I think that it's going to create an awful lot of problems in buying and selling residential real estate because of it. So I have a little reservation in that regard.
Well, Representative Garrard, we could entertain an amendment if you would explain to us what exactly you had in mind.
I'd have to have more time to study it and reword it and that kind of thing, and I know an awful lot of hard work's gone into it. I will vote for the bill to move it out, but I'm hoping that the authors will perhaps address those questions.
Okay. Representative Merkley.
Representative, wouldn't this be the last chance to address the questions you're raising?
Yes, it would. Thank you.
However, it does put it in the record. Your concerns are in the record, and when they do the rulemaking, then they do listen to the tape, I believe.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the hard work that's gone into this, and I do think that it's very helpful to the consumer to see additional details rather than just seeing a broad exclusion or exemption. And I think legitimate issues have been raised that have to get ironed out over time as to, you know, like I, for example, could not tell you the difference between mold and mildew, or if mildew is a subset of a type of mold, technically. So I would probably have to seek some advice, so I better use a realtor to set me straight when I sell a house. But I think in general this is a great idea, and they've done a lot of hard work, and I commend them, and I'll support the bill.
Thank you. Representative Kiss, did you have a comment?
No.
Anyone else? Okay, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Both aye. Motion carries, and the chair will carry the bill. Close the work session. Thank you, everyone, for your very excellent testimony. We learned a great deal. Going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 588A. Welcome Daryl Fuller and guest Daniel. And I have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 588A delays requirement of putting specified brand on certificate of title for vehicles, allows Department of Transportation to adopt rules specifying brand or notation to be placed on certificate of title. Thank you.
Chair, members of the committee, good morning. Daryl Fuller. I represent the Oregon Auto Dealers Association, and I live in a very moldy house here in Salem. I have with me an expert witness today.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Daniel Fuller. I am 7 years old, and I am a first grader at Inglewood.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 588 is essentially a technical change to the statute. We passed a bill last session that allowed the Department of Motor Vehicles to establish brands on motor vehicle titles by rule. And what that did is put us in a circumstance where some of the brands are now listed in statute, and some of them are now listed in rule. So if you wanted to know what the notations on a title were, you'd have to go two different places. So what this bill does is it removes all the brands that are listed in statute so that DMV can add those to the administrative rules so that they'll all be in one place. DMV is not here today because they say it's a technical fix. They're fine with the bill. It shouldn't have any problems at all. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I have a question for Daniel. So, Daniel, what do you think of what Dad does for a living here?
Remember, you're under oath.
keeps your belly full, don't it?
Boring.
Boring. Oh, hey.
That was the real estate bill that was boring. That stuff was exciting. For members of the committee, I will tell you that I have pictures of the chair holding my son at 11 months old when we were at a conference together, so we have a long history with Madam Chair. Daniel, do you have anything that you'd like to say about the bill?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the bill should pass.
Daniel, I think you have a bright future in this boring profession. Okay. Another question or something, Merkley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Daniel, could you tell us anything about the button that you're wearing?
He has yellow writing.
Thank you.
Just keep holding that up.
Okay. Well, that concludes our testimony. Any other questions? Seeing none, close the public hearing. And I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 355. Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair,
I'm sorry, that is 355A. My mistake. I'm sorry. Okay. Go ahead, Representative Kitts.
I move Senate Bill 588A to the floor of the pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 588A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Votes aye. Motion carries. And
Madam Chair, I wonder if this bill might be a good candidate for the consent calendar. Seems non-controversial.
I would amend my motion to include the placing on the consent calendar.
Okay, Representative Kitts, we've already voted on your motion, which has passed.
So, can I make that motion now?
Yes.
Okay. I'll move that we place it on the consent calendar.
Representative Rosenbaum moves that we put Senate Bill 588A on the consent calendar. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Votes aye. Motion carries. And close the work session on Senate Bill 588. Okay. Committee, we have a series of bills that are all related, and so I'm going to open a public hearing on what we're calling the 700 series. It sounds like an expensive car, but it is really not. This is Senate Bill 711A, 13, 14, and 15. So I'm going to open a public hearing, call Mark Long forward, and have him present these bills.
Almost did. Did you want to bring Daniel up?
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Mark Long with Building Codes Division here today to talk to you about the package of bills. These bills are a package we've been working on over on the Senate side to streamline the building code regulatory process. They focus on the building codes area only. This package supports kind of three main goals we've been working with industry on. To provide increased flexibility and alternate methods for regulating the building codes construction. Increase the use of technologies and alternate methods, and support rapid approval of key economic development projects. These bills and the amendments today on two of the bills are the result of several work group meetings we've had, both from the Senate and since they've moved out of the Senate, and represent the work of industry and local government. What I'd like to do is kind of walk you through the bills real quickly, and then be happy to answer any questions that you have. Ready?
We're ready. Thank you.
All right. Senate Bill 711. Senate Bill 711 is amended. You should have dash is it A3 in front of you. This bill allows us to do three things. Work. It goes off. It asks building codes to go off and look at conflicts in the code. See if we can try to streamline our code adoption process and report on the success or our efforts back to the legislature next session. The second thing the bill does is allows architects and engineers to approve certain residential construction plans only. Still requires inspection. by local government. And the third thing the bill does is it limits or provides criteria for electrical and plumbing plan review. The amendments basically just clarify those three things. Changes one word from approved to designed, and changes takes out the word commercial and just has us look at complex structures. Chair, would you like me to go through all of them and take questions, or?
I think that might be helpful. Let's do the overview, and then we can. If everyone will make notations of your questions as we go, then we'll allow time to ask those questions.
Okay, great. I have a question. I heard that Mark was capable of going through these bills in about 3 minutes. I don't know if it's true or not, but that's just what I heard. So I'd like to see if he can do it.
I can do it.
You need time, Representative Kitts, for us.
Ready, go.
Calendar. Senate Bill 713, good bill should pass. Senate Bill 713.
It only works if you're about 2 feet tall.
Okay, what do I need to do?
Take 2 minutes and go out and get the look in.
Senate Bill 713 is our e-government bill. This bill's really directed, it's a permissive bill, asks us to study putting a pilot program in the Tri-County area and look at the rest of the needs for the other 130 jurisdictions around the state. And it's really about building codes, trying to work with local government to provide e-government and electronic permitting for our contractors. Senate Bill 714 allows us to expand our current alternate inspection programs. Basically, there's a lot of notwithstanding language in there. It says go off and do good, work with your boards, and come up with flexible and new ways to provide optional permit systems. And Senate Bill 715 is the rapid approval bill. This bill provides options for rapid development. It aligns and supports the shovel-ready concept for industrial lands that you may have heard about. And it really provides a mechanism to assess the local capacity first through a team that the state will help oversee. And if there's additional resource or needs for the local government, we'll work through those issues. If the local government doesn't have the ability, we'll make those determinations and work with developers to get the project through timely. And this is about it.
The bill should pass.
All of them.
Okay, questions, Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. The electronic permitting. So if a contractor just wanted a simple tear out and replace permit for a driveway, for example, in the right of way, they'd be able to do it electronically rather than driving downtown Portland and getting a permit. Is that where we're going with this?
Chair Close, Representative Shoffler, that's the goal, is to get our over the counter types of permits available online. Have a single place where a contractor or owner could access it, get their information, go about their business, and get inspected.
That's a great idea.
Can I ask why you didn't put these bills on one bill? It'd just be too big a bill, or what was your thinking doing the separate bills?
Chair Close, they have some different thoughts, and I think that as we went through the amendment process, we realized that we had to deal with each issue individually. So it was a sequence of things where industry had come to us with problems they'd been working on over a period of time, and so we just dissected them out separately because we weren't sure when we started this process exactly where we'd end up. And,
okay.
You know, the original set had six bills, and we have four before you today.
Okay. So. Representative
Fields? I would just echo Representative Shoffler's sentiments and thank you for the governor, you know, in his state of the state, not his state, his inaugural address, talked about streamlining, and I'm happy to be part of it. And thank you. I think this is going to make business in Oregon a lot more friendly. So I'm enthusiastically waiting to vote on it.
Other questions? Okay, thank you very much, Mark. You've done an excellent job. We appreciate your work.
How'd I do?
Mighty fine.
You went so fast, a number of members of the committee here expected you would take longer. They are not here.
I know about that.
Did anyone else want to comment on any of these bills? Mr. Shiprack, did you?
You had to do it.
Madam Chair, members of the
committee. I'm Bob Shiprock, Executive Secretary of the Urban Building Trades Council. I was asked to just give you a brief history of this. About 18 months ago, Burton Wiest called me at my office, and he says, you know, he says, I think this recession's going to last a while, and I think this is a good time that we should get the whole construction industry together to talk about how we could make the process work better in Oregon. I thought it was an excellent idea, and I got ahead, went ahead and contacted just everyone I could think of, key players in the construction industry, developers, commercial real estate brokers, contractors, subcontractors, myself. We all got together in a room. There must have been 30 of us. We set up a couple series, or actually a couple meetings, formal meetings, and we just made a list of what are the problems with permit, plan review, how do you get something built in this state, come up with a comprehensive list. We then had a rule that everyone at the table had to have unanimous agreement or it didn't go forward. So that was kind of the genesis of some of these ideas. We then took them to the Building Codes Division because obviously they're going to have to enforce a lot of this. They had their own thoughts and helped us refine these concepts. But I'm real happy to say that this is a result of real people out there that do this every day, that we all got our heads together and said we had to look at a better process and system for doing construction in this state, in this narrow process. What would it look like? There were some land use issues as well brought up, but we decided to separate those out, and there are other bills dealing with the land use issues. This is just permit process because we didn't want to confuse the issues. So I'm just here to give you that brief history. A lot of folks came together on this. It was unanimous decisions, and I hope you see fit to pass this. And I can speak just for myself. I think this is going to make a significant difference in our ability for economic growth in the entire state. This is stuff that should have been done a long time ago, and we just finally pulled ourselves all together to work real hard on this package. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Questions for Bob? Well, thank you very much. We look forward to you know, seeing the progress of this, the pilot project, and
yeah,
seeing how it works out. Thank you for your work.
Okay,
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 711, 713, 714, and 715, the A versions. And I'm going to open a work session on... Should we do the work sessions in or together? That's right. Okay. All right, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 711A. Representative Kitt.
I'm sorry?
That's a dash three.
Madam Chair, I would move that we accept the dash three amendments into Senate Bill 711A.
Representative Kitt moves the dash three amendment into Senate Bill 711A. Is there discussion? Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 711A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 711A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I would just comment that clearly there's no opposition. It passed unanimously in the Senate, and we might consider putting it on the consent calendar.
Representative Gallegos, there are those who would like to make speeches based on what we're doing
no
here.
No problem.
So that's why we haven't done that.
The reason we should put them in the consent calendar.
I don't make one of these. Do you?
Madam Chair, I would not amend my motion.
Okay.
Sorry?
Not. Further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative
Berkeley? Aye.
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 Representative Rosenbaum? Aye. Votes aye. Motion carries. And we will have Representative Kitts carry this bill. Close the work session. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 713A.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kitts.
I would move Senate Bill 713A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 713A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Votes aye. Motion carries, and Representative Schaffler will carry this bill.
Thank you.
I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 714A.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kipps.
I would move Senate Bill 714A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kipps moves Senate Bill 714A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call roll.
Aye.
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 Votes aye. Motion carries. Representative Girard will carry this bill. Close the work session. Opening a work session on Senate Bill 715A.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kipps.
I would move the dash 3 amendments into Senate Bill 715A.
Representative Kipps moves the dash 3 amendment into Senate Bill 715A. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Votes aye. Motion carries. Representative Gallegos, will you share this bill?
I promise not to do a long speech. Yes, I will do it.
Thank you very much, and you're limited to 2-minute speeches. Close the work session. All right. 700.
Good bill should pass.
Okay, we have one more item of business committee. Thank you for your hard work. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 285 and call Lisa Trussell.
I'll have the help in the back of the room.
Doesn't have anything to do with mold, Lisa. You're probably okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and thank you for hearing Senate Bill 285 today. No, it doesn't deal with trading drugs for sex or mold and mildew. It's a simple workers' comp bill.
Organic Viagra, maybe?
Senate Bill 285 is, it's a technical fix. In 1999, the DCBS had gone through a process of taking functions that they didn't think were regulatory and eliminating them. And one of the functions they had done was close certain workers' comp claims. And there were certain claims they were required to close if it was going to be a permanent and total award, or there were also optional claims. If a carrier just wanted the department to close the claim, you could send it over and they'd close it. Well, that was really an administrative function after we went to standards on how we rate disability. So in 1999, the legislature eliminated the workers' comp division from closing workers' comp claims, and they required carriers to close their own claims. Well, prior to 1999, if you had sent a claim over to the department to close and you disagreed with the findings, you could request reconsideration. But when we eliminated that section of the workers' comp division, we had only what's called the notice of closure statute, which was the statute a carrier used to close, and that wasn't an option under that. This bill, Senate Bill 285, has been through the MLAC committee, and they're supportive of it. And basically, it returns notice of closure. It gives you the same standing we had when the department was closing claims. It will allow either the worker or the employer, or the carrier, I should say, to appeal a notice of closure on those issues for the carrier and the self-insured employers. It's for those issues where they disagree with the findings used to rate the claim. So there are also some amendments that will be forthcoming for Senate Bill 285 that are intended to do two things. One is to limit the amount of time a carrier has to appeal their closure. So practically speaking, I think most carriers will do it probably at the time they issue it. But they would it would limit them to 7 days. They have 7 days to decide to make that request. And then the other thing it does is it puts in some processes that were in place when we had both determination orders and notices of closure so that you only end up with one reconsideration, but everybody has the right to get to one. Again, this bill is supported by the MLAC committee, and we'd ask that when we get the amendments that you consider supporting this bill as well. Thank you.
And Lisa, those amendments have been submitted, is that correct?
Yes.
They just haven't arrived?
Yes.
Okay. So we do have a time constraint, so we will try to expedite those amendments if we can through Legislative Council.
Okay.
Questions on the issue? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess it would be easier for me to understand why the insurer would want to ask for reconsideration if we were still doing closures by the agency, but when they've closed the claim themselves, why would they want to ask for reconsideration of their own closure?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, we've limited it. As you'll recall, you're required to close a claim based on the attending physician's findings. And one of the reasons the decision was made not to have the department close claims anymore is because when you use those findings, regardless of who closes it, you're going to come up pretty close to the same answer because of the standard. So this would occur when the insurer or self-insured employer disagrees with the findings of the attending physician that they have to use.
And a follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
It looks like there were some no votes, seven.
There were seven no votes.
You know what that was based on?
I believe it was because, it could have been because some of the injured worker groups. MLAC supported it. So it wasn't, there wasn't a labor issue.
Other questions?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. We will await those amendments and try to get to that. Bring this bill back early next week. So that concludes the testimony. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 285. And if there's nothing else for the good of the committee, we are adjourned.